Okay, good afternoon. I want to start with giving you an update on the SAS. The New Zealand SAS were involved in an incident in Kabul last Friday. Up to 15 SAS personnel accompanied an Afghan unit responding to an incident where a car bomb had been exploded and then a building occupied by insurgents. During the incident, some members of the SAS were fired upon by insurgents and they returned fire. Before the insurgents could be apprehended by Afghan security forces, they blew themselves up. There's all the information that we're able to release on the incident at this time. What I can tell you, though, is that no SAS personnel were hurt in the incident. I understand that there were some civilian casualties in the initial car bomb blast. In terms of government activity for this week, the government had a wide-ranging discussion on various issues today at Cabinet, one of which was Schedule 4. In terms of conservation land. No decisions were made today, however it is expected that the Schedule 4 discussion document will be released sometime in the next few weeks. Another government activity this week, tomorrow the Minister of Finance will release the National Infrastructure Plan at a speech he is giving in Auckland. The plan is part of a range of work aimed at improving the planning, decision-making and management of infrastructure in order to maximise the economic benefits. The plan provides a snapshot of public and private infrastructure, planned investment and outlines government priorities. It is not a shopping list of new, previously unannounced projects, but it does show that the government has a very large infrastructure program underway. Also tomorrow, the Minister of Labour will release a comprehensive discussion document on personal grievance provisions. There are concerns about the current system, including uncertainty about the law and the ability for parties to spin out the legal process for years. The discussion document will seek submissions on issues related to personal grievances. On Thursday, Wayne Mapp will release the CRI Task Force report. Also on Thursday, Jerry Brownlee will be speaking at the commissioning of the Maori oil field. Today you will have seen, just moving on from that, today you will have seen a press release from Paula Bennett which announces an increase in benefit and superannuation payments from April 1. All benefits and pensions will increase by 1.96% to keep pace with the cost of living increases. On top of that, superannuation and veteran pension rates will be further adjusted to bring them up to 66% of net average wages. That will take the total increase in super and veterans' pension rates to 2.31%. More than a million New Zealanders will benefit from these changes. It was a manifesto commitment to retain super and veteran payments at 66% of the net average weekly wage, and National is sticking to that commitment. In terms of activity of the week, tomorrow I will be in the Hutt Valley, Porirua and Johnsonville, and advisory has already been circulated about that. On Wednesday I'm opening the Agricultural Greenhouse Gas Centre at Agri Researchers Grasslands Campus at Palmerston North. On Thursday I have a day of events, meetings and functions in Auckland, and on Friday I'm on a regional visit to Taupo, and on Saturday morning I have the honour of starting the Ironman event. Operative word meaning starting as opposed to competing. That's it.
This is the first time the OSA exhibition fired shots in Andrew.
I can't say it's the first time, I'm not sure actually, but I know that certainly in terms of the instance that I've been reported on, it's the first time I'm aware, but there could have been others. Up to 15 in total. No injuries. No, they understand they did wound some of the insurgents, and ultimately they took their own life before things went any further.
So what other forces were involved?
Don't know. Largely our guys were part of the crisis response unit and working with the Afghan National Police, I think it's understand. Don't know the answer. I know there were 8 civilians, and I think there was 8 insurgents, but not exactly sure on that number.
The civilians who died at the bomb.
I think the initial bomb blast, yeah. Don't know the answer to that question.
Just on the missile spending.
Yep.
Do you think that the Auditor General should look at all national parties' ministerial breakdowns and make sure that these things are complete?
Well, look, firstly, I think that's a matter for the Auditor General. So I've given her, you know, a signal that we'd like her to look at Phil Heatley, and she's doing that. She's also looking at the wider procedures and operation of ministerial services. But actually, the mandate in terms of reference are for her, and she may well extend it. I'm just, it's not my call.
But you think it's unfair that Heatley's going to get all the feet, if you like.
Yep.
And there could be other ministers sort of sitting back in both your administration and the previous ones thinking,
well, look, in due course, the information on the previous administration is going to be released in the same way that ours was, because that's been requested by a number of media outlets, and as I understand it, ministerial services are collating that information. So that'll be released in due course. I guess if it opens up any areas of interest, then that'll be a something for a future day.
Have you had a heads up at all about any misspending or questionable spending under the previous administration?
I haven't, no. I haven't asked those questions.
Will you look at
those
details before they get released as the Minister of Child?
I think it may come to us first. I'm not 100% sure. I haven't actually inquired on that. My main inquiry has been about how long it will take. My understanding is that there's obviously 3 years for the previous administration, so it will take a little bit of time.
Do you think it would be fair if you were to get a bit wider there, inquiring though, to further field? I know you're looking at
Well, the initial Information Act request was very specific, and we released it for all ministers, as I understand it. That was quite a lot of documentation that ultimately was released, and my understanding is it didn't bring up any other areas of concern other than ones highlighted, and I think they've been satisfactory answers, as far as I'm concerned, have been produced so far for those. So I'm not concerned about other national ministers. In terms of the previous administration, I haven't seen that information yet, so I can't comment on it.
Have you spoken to Phil
Heatley
since?
I haven't, but I think quite a number of the caucus and cabinet have had discussion with him. Well, look, in the end, I think, you know, there was a way through, which was to stand down at least until the Auditor General's report was produced. But as I've said on numerous occasions now, he chose not to take that course. But when we have the Auditor General's report back, that'll give us an opportunity to reflect on that. Decision about whether he could be returned to Cabinet at that time or in the future will depend on a number of factors, including what the Auditor General's report looked like and my wider perspective on the whole incident. I wouldn't want to either rule that in or rule that out at this time.
You don't think he's being dishonest?
I personally don't think he's a dishonest individual. I think he has certainly sometimes appears, at least, to push the boundary, but I don't think he's a dishonest person.
I'm in danger of prejudging the Auditor General report by making comments like, well, it might come out that he just made mistakes rather than deliberate. I wouldn't really be steer clear of any kind of comment in that direction.
Well, it's up to the Auditor General to, you know, go through the information and sift her way through it and factually report, and she'll do that.
You don't think you've given her any signal in terms of maybe your expectation?
I've only offered a view on what I know as the individual person and of the information that I've seen. I can only comment in that regard. I don't think it's contaminated the report. I'm sure she will do undertake her investigation and write her report exactly as she sees fit.
That's how he pushes the
boundary. Oh, no, I just think, you know, you saw that where, you know, some ministers might claim things, others might not. Well, that's the sort of thing I'm talking about. Well, I mean, look, it is what it is, so I'm not going to bother relitigating it.
Do you think it raises wider questions about the ethical conduct? Not just of ministers, but of MPs across all parties. We've had a range of issues come out over the last year or so. Do you think there's a concern about the ethical conduct of politicians?
My personal view is that the... I'd like to think all MPs are actually honest, upfront, trustworthy people. And I think if you look at our Parliament and our members of Parliament and you contrast them around to other parliaments around the world, you know, I've never seen in my time in Parliament any evidence of corruption or wrongdoing from people. There'll always be a range of the ways people apply for things or do things, but as a general rule, I haven't seen that. And I think there are two important points here. I mean, one is that, well, firstly, the world's changing, as I've said on numerous occasions, and there is greater transparency. There's greater transparency around the world. Ultimately, it just puts a different level of disclosure out there. just in the same way that all sorts of things around this place have changed in the last 10, 20, 30 years. It's just an evolution in Parliament's history. Secondly, I think, and in defence of both MPs and ministers, I think the media do need to think a little bit about what is legitimate spending within the rules, even if they don't like the rules, vis-a-vis someone breaking the law. So if someone breaks the rules, they're fair game. If somebody complies with the rules but the media doesn't like that, that doesn't make that person necessarily a bad person. So, I just make that point, but I'm not overly defensive about it.
But equally, isn't the problem, though, with that you're looking to close loopholes, for instance, around tax and what have you, people are using legitimately the law to get what they are entitled to, and is there a sense, perhaps, that some politicians, they do have a sense of entitlement?
Well, the law, again, the laws be differences of approach, but as a general rule, I don't think that's the... I think members and ministers just try and work through the rules as they see fit, and it is just a slightly different operating environment to ones that a lot of other people deal with, and the hours and different things cause different effects. But at the end of the day, I mean, we have a set of rules which are put in place for this place to function. So if you think about things like housing, the provision of housing, that just reflects the fact that Parliament's based in one place and 120 members largely come from somewhere different. It creates some rules. Sometimes people don't like it, but it kind of is what it is, isn't it? I mean, it's a function of the place that we live in.
Do you accept that you've lost the moral high ground when you've got public servants who are being expected to do more with less and make the most of limited resources, and MPs just carry on the same?
Well, I think MPs and ministers actually have been changing. If you were to reflect on what's been happening in terms of ministerial expenses, as a general rule, greater scrutiny seems to me to be reducing the amount that they are spending. You saw that in the last round of disclosures.
Isn't that part of the problem, that it's taken more transparency for the behaviour to change rather than the behaviour actually being as people would expect in the first place?
Well, it goes back to that question I was posing earlier, which is a truly philosophical question. So if you take the issue of spouses travel or international travel for holiday purposes where a discount can apply, I think to a lot of the general public, they would say that just doesn't seem like a justified expense. And I can understand that, why they would say that. And there have been ministers that have got themselves on the wrong side of public opinion for using that. But actually, it is, as it's currently structured, a legitimate part of the contract, if you like, that MPs have. Now, it might be outdated, and it might have been brought in place because you got in a situation where pay rises were forgiven, all those sorts of things. But nevertheless, it's there. So, I don't...
But really, they've only got off on the public side because there's maybe been hypocrisy or something like that. There have been several MPs or ministers who have taken spouses or done that, and haven't actually caused any concern. Isn't it really the only ones who have been asking one thing with the public and doing another with their own business that's got them into the problem?
I'm not sure it's as straightforward as that, actually, no. Well, look, I wouldn't want to, prejudge the release of that discussion document, except to say we think that there are opportunities to extend mining activity in New Zealand, and it's been our belief that we can do so in a way that wouldn't damage our environmental or conservation credentials, nor damage New Zealand's overall sort of 100% pure brand. In the last 3 or 4 months, we've been working through that process to try and refine that, and I think we are getting very close to a discussion document that's worthy of being put in the public domain, but I'm not going to speculate about what it looks like until that discussion document's released.
And have you been following the public about your attitude to
Schedule 4? Not to the best of my knowledge in recent times, no.
That's a denial. You've not done any focus polling on the public on the subject?
Not to the best of my knowledge in recent times. I think there was some questions asked when it first came out, but that was early last year. Not this year. Actually showed what the public polls have generally showed, which is, generally speaking, there's support. It's not overwhelming, but there is support. But I think like any sort of question, it's caveated around what does it look like and what does it actually mean. I think it's one of those things where I think the answer is it depends, and it depends on what areas affected and what implications are resulting from that.
Just on the conference that you discussed last week, and we talked a lot about the penalties for the serious type of attacks on police. In terms of increasing respect for them, do you think there's a need to look more at the sort of low-level abuse, street abuse, verbal abuse?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, as a general rule, actually, the police are held in high regard, and one of the ways that works effectively is the police these days play quite an important role in schools. They're often in and talking in schools, and they build a relationship with young people and build a relationship with communities, so I'd like to think that respect level is quite high. It's a question of whether we move to recognising their role, and whether they should have there should be a specific regime of penalties that apply to people that breach those rules when it regards police officers. Now, my understanding is that some initial work's been done and it's looking interesting, but again, it's just too early to comment on.
I'm talking about low-level abuse on the street. Someone yells out at an officer, squeezes them, or what have you.
Yeah.
Whether it's sort of crack down on their and sort of broken windows.
Yeah, well, we probably need to get advice on that. We certainly haven't had that at this stage.
Do you have any update on the situation in Chile, and what's New Zealand doing to help?
Yeah, so I've had an update this morning. I mean, just in general, firstly, we've obviously passed our condolences to the president of Chile, Michelle Bachelet, and to the people of Chile. We've also made it clear that once they've had an opportunity to assess the damage, New Zealand would be willing to help and give support where required. Initial indications are it's unlikely that Chile will be asking for significant international support, but we would do so if that was required. No, we didn't. I'm happy with it. Look, I mean, I think you can always have an endless debate about these matters, but, I mean, firstly, I mean, make a couple of points. I mean, the initial advice that I got, which was around about midnight on Saturday night, was that there wouldn't be a tsunami alert warning issued, and the reason for that was that while it was a very large earthquake, 8.8 on the Richter scale, it was very deep, 55 kilometres deep. So if you contrast that to, say, Haiti, where it was a lower impact, but much more shallow. The impact was much greater on the environment. That was later changed by the Tsunami Warnings Centre in Hawaii. And when you think about New Zealand did what every other country that was likely to be affected by the tsunami did. It wasn't unique to New Zealand. I mean, Australia followed the same course of action, so did other countries around the world. Now, it's easy in hindsight to say maybe we shouldn't have acted, but if with that information and with that happening around the rest of the world, if New Zealand hadn't acted and then New Zealanders died, I'd strongly suggest, the Minister of Civil Defence would be gone and I might well be gone. And that's because New Zealanders have an expectation that their governments will take these things seriously. So of course we need to be at a point where I think we respond appropriately. Now, we've got to balance that between making sure that people don't get so blasé, but we just acted in unison with other countries, and I think that's appropriate myself.
Would you give consideration to delegated authority to arrest to civil events or other people?
Yeah, look, I mean, that would be a big step. We're just trying to educate New Zealanders that, tsunami is a very dangerous thing. As we saw in Samoa, it moves at frightening speeds. The impact and the capacity for people to respond is just non-existent. And while we can all sit back and say, wow, the waves weren't that high, it could have been vastly different.
In a way, I mean, we were lucky with the number of people that have been reported to be out here or on the coast. It could have made the situation a lot worse.
Well, the reality is if it had been a significant tsunami, New Zealanders would have died. and maybe in quite large numbers because they weren't taking the civil defence warning seriously.
So much national scientists which have admitted that they're overstated in this, in hindsight, and they said they did so because they didn't want to be accused of overstating.
And that's the dilemma.
Do you think that perhaps what we actually need is to get some better science around this so that more accurate warnings can be given to people to avoid the situation where they are told to evacuate and then nothing?
Yeah, that may be fair. I can't comment on it because I haven't seen it. All I can say is, you know, we rely on the Tsunami Warning Centre in Hawaii. We rely on the advice that we get, and we act when we get that advice. And New Zealand was in lockstep with the other countries that received that advice. Now, I have to agree that it's important that balance is preserved and that we're not, you know, crying wolf every 5 seconds. But we do have to take these things seriously if that's the advice that we get. I haven't, no.
We've got documents, information act showing that the ministers were briefed on what to say if there was an injury or death in the Southern Ocean.
Yep.
You don't think that, given you're thinking like that, maybe New Zealand should have sent a vessel down to patrol?
No, I don't, actually. We made it quite clear, and we've been making it quite clear for a long period of time, that it's just not possible for us to provide the sort of support services if people go down there. We've made it clear we think the diplomatic solution is the right way to go, and we remain in that view.
Just going back to mining, are you worried that there could be a public backlash to what you're proposing, and is that leading to have second thoughts or to scale back your ambition?
No. I think when the minister first mooted the idea, he actually made it quite clear that people shouldn't read too much into it, that it was genuinely a stock take. We'll be working our way through it and reflecting on what we think is right and what is achievable. And you'll see that, I think when you see the discussion document, I think we've got that balance about right. And of course, there will always be those that are opposed to any move. But on the other side of the coin, people also want better public services, and they want the government to have more resources to be able to pay for those public services, and we need to extend, you know, where we can make money in those areas. And you know, that balance has to be appropriately reached between that and our conservation beliefs.
What would be an example of a sustainable mining project?
Well, one where we can mine an area of land and do so without substantial disruption to the environment. Well, there's 82 or 92 concessions currently on the Dock Estate, and to the best of my knowledge, most of them have worked effectively.
Are you actually looking at the potential damage to New Zealand's tourism brand? I mean, even if you can mine sustainably, just the fact that national parks are involved?
Well, first I wouldn't jump to conclusions, but secondly, as the Minister of Tourism, and having read the discussion documents, and my view is I'm comfortable with the way it's progressing.
So will you just be releasing the discussion document without government comment, or will you actually be saying what you're going to do?
No, it's truly a discussion document, so we'll release it, and there'll be feedback over a 2 or 3 month period.
Returning to Afghanistan just for a moment.
Yeah.
How long do you expect the SAS to be involved in crisis response?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, that may be part of their mandate for the whole 18 months they're there.
Are you looking at expanding that beyond?
Beyond the 18 months? No, that's not our expectation.
Okay. Would you say that we are fighting in Afghanistan at this point now, as opposed to reconstruction?
Well, I'd say the provincial reconstruction team in Bamyan is primary and sole role is really around reconstruction, and the SAS are there to act on, you know, what is required of them. Some of that is combat, as I've said before. Yes, there was a discussion today. Final decisions haven't been made there. We're working through the options, but the Minister did give Cabinet an update on sort of his initial thinking and reflected on the discussion that's taken place in the last week or so with local mayors and local stakeholders. Great, thank you.